I'm giving this talk this morning for two reasons. The first is to convey the depth and breadth of psychiatry, how the practice over the last four decades has changed, was much broader than the narrow type psychiatry we see today. The second reason is opens a window so you can see why I chose psychiatry as my specialty in the first place. I was thinking of lots of other things like OB-GYN and internal medicine, but I ended up with psychiatry, and I think that you'll understand that a little bit better after this talk. I've picked out five stories from hundreds of patients that I've seen over the past 40 years, and it was difficult to do, but I'm going to select five vignettes, five case studies, but before that I'm going to give you five vignettes, because 10 out of thousands is not, it's kind of hard to pick out. The first vignette includes family dynamics and sibling rivalry. All of us know the story of Cain and Abel and how Cain killed his younger brother because God had regard for Abel and his offering, but he had no regard for Cain and his offering. So my first vignette is a similar story in which I had a young teenager on the young side who had slit his brother's throat. His parents were out grocery shopping, and he slit his brother's throat, ran out, got on his bicycle, rode around the neighborhood, and then came back and ran to the neighbor saying someone had broken into the house. And I won't go into details about his treatment except to say that he was treated inpatient for a year, and then he came through that pretty good, but he had to go on to Boys Ranch, and he stayed there until he was graduating from high school. And after that, he went on to college and did get married. He was able to make some kind of a change with his dad, but not with his mom. The basic problem was that the mom felt like she had to marry the dad when she became pregnant. And she did not like the dad at all. And the son looked exactly like the dad. So several years later, she got pregnant with another young son, who was completely different, was nothing like, the other two men in her life. And she could never forgive this. The second vignette, I had a high functioning child in his young teens as well. And he had childhood schizophrenia. He could only speak in metaphor. And so I had to learn how, this was in my residency, my fellowship, but I had to learn to speak in metaphor. I had to understand his metaphor. And then I went on, after I was able to be fluent in metaphor, I knew that he had to be brought out of the metaphor and into the real world. But I knew that it was going to be a very frightening thing on my part, because if I took the wrong time, said it at the wrong time, he could regress. However, he didn't regress, and he went on to gradually speak normally. He engaged in group therapy there at the hospital, and then he also started getting involved with the kids in public school who went on there. Third, there was a middle-aged man. I thought he was old back then, but I think he was probably in his 50s. And he came into the emergency room, and I was on call. And he had on a jacket, and he was holding it real close, and he looked very frightened, and you could really smell the liquor on his breath. And I walked in and asked him what was going on. He had pressured speech, and he was disheveled, and he smelled bad. And he said, well, Doc, he said, I heard all of this noise. I was trying to get some sleep, and I went over to the window. I live on the second floor of this apartment complex. I heard all this racket, and I went out there really quickly and looked out the window, and there was a spaceship in the yard. And then I heard this chatter, and I looked up, and there were all of these monkeys in the palm tree that was growing right next to my window, and they had space clothes on, and they had weapons that I'd never seen before. So I had to get my pistol. I didn't have anything better than that, but I did get this pistol, and I started shooting them, ended up having to call the police because I really was afraid. And I said, do you still have your gun on you right now? And he said, yes, I do. He says, I'll show you my weapon. And he opened his vest and he went in and he pulled out this bright yellow banana. And he said, this is my weapon. And it worked. The fourth one is, I admitted him to the drug rehab unit where he stayed for quite a while. The fourth vignette is taking place in San Antonio. And I was working, evaluating service members for various and sundry problems, primarily PTSD. He came in, he was tall, well-built, he had on cut-off jeans, he had on a t-shirt, he had long raggedy hair, and he had a bandana holding his hair back, kind of like Steve, listening to Steve. And anyway, he came in and shut the door. I told him to have a seat. He sat across the desk from me. And I saw him take something out of his pocket. He put a gun on the desk. Little did I know that I had no window to that office. It was really small. There was a phone there, but it didn't work. And so there was no panic button either. So what happened is I thought, well, Bev, what you gonna do now? And so I bent over to look at the pistol, and around his waist was a belt with two scabbards with machetes that were about 18 inches long on his person. So he, I felt like he was just trying to scare me and frighten me. He didn't look dangerous. He didn't appear dangerous. So I started asking him about his gun, and he started telling me, and then he shared with me that he had a lot of guns in his home, and I got him out of there as quickly as possible, and I went out, not a very happy camper, and said, I got to have an office with a window on the door so at least someone could see if there's a racket going on. I need to have a phone that works, and a panic button might be nice. Now, I've always had a panic button, but I've never had to use one. But it makes you feel better. Okay. So, I'm going to skip the next one because of time, and I'll go to the first case. And this case was the Wasper minister. His name was Hank. He was a man in his mid-30s. He was admitted to my service at the Appalachian Regional Hospital in Hazard, Kentucky during the night. When I came to work the next morning, I was told that I had a family of one of the patients that had been admitted to my service waiting in a large therapy room because they didn't think Hank would tell the full story of what had happened the previous day. So they lived at the end of a holler. And in Kentucky, they have the nicer homes at the front of the holler, and then as you go back, you get into worse homes and at dead ends. And the kids that had gone out to play were quite alarmed, and they ran into their parents' houses because the family all lived in the same area and said, "Oh, you've got to come out," said, "Uncle Hank is at it again." And Hank was in probably his mid-30s, and he had long kind of brownish blonde hair. And his folks got together, got their clothes on and ran out. And there was Hank standing on top of a car, naked. Didn't have a stitch of clothes on. And he was preaching. They kept telling him to get down. "You've got to get down and you've got to get some clothes on." He just ignored them and he just kept on talking. So the family started worrying about him burning because it was in the summertime. It was really hot already. So they filled buckets and every 15 or 20 minutes they'd shove some water on Hank. So finally it was getting late and the family was worn out. And what about Hank? He kept sliding off the car and then he'd get back on the car. So after that, they decided they would call the EMT and have them come out and pick Uncle Hank up. So Hank went on to the hospital and the family came with him because you can see why they needed to fill me in on a few things. So after I talked with them and they gave me some background stating they'd had problems with him almost all of his life and these delusions were around religious things. And he would refuse to take his medication. They would find pills all over the house. And sometimes he would cheat the medication and then he would go throw it in the flower bed or something. So I went in to see Hank. And everybody in the holler where Hank lived, I'm going to go back a little bit, had worked in the coal mines. And they had worked in the coal mines their whole life, and there was not anything left there but coal mining. And the coal mining had been shut down, so none of these people worked. And as all of the racket got louder and louder, everybody in the holler started coming down to see what was going on in Hank's part of the woods. So he said, I went into him in another examination room and told him that I had already talked with his family. And he said, "Well, I don't know what all the fuss about is." Says, "I want you to know I'm Jesus Christ. And I was just trying to save my flock." And maybe you could help me out. I said, why did were you standing naked out there on the car in front of men and women and little girls, children? He says, oh, did they tell you that? He said, I can explain it. I was standing on top of the car so that everyone could see me. I had on my pants, but he said, I didn't know they were unzipped. And he said, I was preaching, and a wasper flew down and landed on my pants. And I just kept preaching. I didn't notice the wasper, and he crawled in my pants. And he said, I started jumping around and trying to get that wasper out of my pants. Wouldn't you take your britches off, too, if you had a wasper in your pants? He said. I said, well, you know, I think I really would. He said, well, I really have to tell you that I am Jesus Christ. And I said, well, you know, you will really enjoy yourself here. Because we have three more Jesuses on this unit, and you will be able to get along with them really well, and you might share your experiences. Next case, a question involving danger. I was going in, this was in San Antonio also, to make rounds. I was running the crisis unit there in San Antonio, and I saw several police cars, and there was a lot of things going on, and I said, what is going on here? As I ran into the nurse's station, because there were five police officers. There was a nurse, there was a nurse assistant, there were psych techs. And I looked out in the waiting, in the area, kind of like about this size, and there was this large, heavy fella, and he was sitting out there just as quiet as he could be, not another patient in sight, until I looked beyond the room and saw that the patients had been locked out in the backyard because they were afraid for their safety. So he apparently had gotten, he was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he had quit taking his medications, and the voices were telling him that he, that the police were going to do something to him. So he was not dangerous in the sense that he was mean, but he was afraid because the voices were telling him to do these things. And he did attack a police officer, and that's why they brought him in. But when I asked him about that, I had his chart in my hand, and I heard words like huge, dangerous, psychotic. But I wasn't listening too carefully because I saw this fella sitting out there, and he seemed really frightened. And I went out there, unlocked the door. I went out there to where he was sitting, and I put my hand on his shoulder. It's like a table, like a picnic table with benches, and he was sitting on the bench. I sat next to him, and I said, everything's going to be okay. And I put my hand on his shoulder, and he began to cry softly. In the meantime, unbeknownst to me, the nurse in the nurse's station started getting really angry with the police. They said, are you going to let that little lady go in there and face that man all by herself? Well, I didn't think I was ever a little lady, but that's what she said. And so she had gotten a syringe full of Haldol and Ativan, which is a mixture that is used frequently in patients who need some sedation. And they were going, she told them that they had to go in there and take that man down, and she would give them the injection. And I had not ordered it. So they came running out, took him down, he got the injection, And I promised, like, handcuffed him and drug him to the seclusion room. And I went with him and sat down in the seclusion room with him and told him that everything was going to be okay, that I would see that he was out of his handcuffs and out of the seclusion room very rapidly. He continued to be my patient as an outpatient, and we had a really good rapport until one morning he came in and one look in his eye, and I knew that I had been added to his delusional system in a negative way. So I had to turn him over to another psychiatrist at that point. Once you get in the delusional system, it's really hard to get out. Case number three is something that you probably haven't heard of too much, called root work. This was way back years ago when I first started practice, and a colleague of mine called me and said, "Would you please," said, "I need to talk to you." Said, "Will you do some root work?" He said, "Will you do an exorcism?" And he was a prankster. He was so funny all the time, I didn't believe a word he said. And I said, "Sure." And thinking that he was, you know, pulling a prank. Well, he was serious. There was an elderly lady, and she was from Louisiana. And her friend had gotten into a fight with each other. And the friend put a hex on her, which is pretty common in Louisiana in the southern part. And the woman told her that she would never be able to eat and that she would die. And she hadn't eaten. She hadn't eaten for days, and it was obvious when I walked in because she was fragile and listless. And so this jokester friend of mine had a partner, and he said, "Oh, I want to do this with you." Well, I'd never done anything like that before and thought it was kind of crazy. So we got together, and we got some sheets, and we got some rattles, and we set up some candles in her room, and we had some water, and we had Bibles in our hands, and we gave her some scriptures and said a lot of things and sprinkled her with some water. And I thought, well, I don't guess this can hurt any. And that was back when you didn't get in trouble for doing crazy things like that. But I told her that her hex would be gone. Well, the next morning I made rounds, and there she was sitting up in a chair, and she was eating breakfast. She had a smile on her face, and she said, "Oh, I'm so appreciative that you just saved my life." And I went over and looked in the chart, and my friend had written across the whole page that was like this big, said, "Cured by Dr. Beverly Vanderpool." So, you know, mind over matter helps sometimes. And of course, she didn't receive any medication. She didn't need any. Okay, how's our time? Okay, borderline. Have you all heard of a borderline personality disorder? That's a pretty difficult thing to treat. These folks more often than not have been sexually abused, physically abused, abandoned throughout their life, and they just can't get enough. You just have to keep giving them and giving them. Well, this is when I first started my practice, and I hadn't even heard of a borderline. That wasn't even invented back then. And they're like burr rabbit and the tar baby. The more you give them, the more they want, and you just get stuck and stuck and stuck. And at first, she would call me on the phone, and she would say, "Dr. Vanderpool, I'm really, really depressed, and I've taken 3 of those yellow pills you gave me." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm really worried about that. Those are really, really strong pills. And I just took another one," she said. And so I motioned to my secretary to please call an ambulance and send them to her house. Well, that was kind of a bad thing to do. And she would also call me throughout the night, call me throughout the day. She would try to give me gifts. She didn't have any boundaries at all. She would cut herself, which borderlines frequently do, burn themselves with cigarettes. And I realized that you have to be really strict with these people, set boundaries. And once you've really got a rapport with a person with a borderline personality disorder, you can tell them, you know, if you try another suicide attempt, you will no longer be my patient. I'll have to refer you to someone else. And that works a lot. But after that very first episode that I told you about, one of the very, very later ones, this is how it went. Again, she called me, and she says, "I feel bad. I've taken 6 of those brown pills, and I've got to get to kill myself. What should I do?" And I said, "Well, you know, you're probably going to die. And if I were you, I would go vomit up those pills." And she says, but how? I don't know what to do. What should I do?" I said, "Well, I don't know, but you better start thinking quick." And I said, "Just go ahead and make yourself vomit. Stick your finger down your throat." And she did. She ran in the bathroom. I could hear her. And I told her to come back as soon as she had been successful. And even though she was getting sleepy, she was able to get rid of the poison she had put down her throat. And the last one is going to be real quick. I had 2 young brothers. They had curly blonde hair, and they were 19 and 22. And the mother always brought them in. But I could never see their eyes. They kept their head down like this. And they said, well, they didn't say, their mother said, because they wouldn't talk. If they did talk, it was in an angry outburst. And she said she just couldn't get the kids to take their medication. And the dad said, "There's nothing wrong with them." And at night, she could hear them pounding on the walls, breaking windows, throwing things, and yelling, "Get away from me!" Because they were hearing voices. They get louder at night because there's not anything to make them think of other things. And a new medication had just come out, and it's an injection. And now we have like 5 of those. But this one, the younger one agreed to take the injection. And an injection will last a month, and you don't have to worry about pills. But they have to agree to do it. Well, the younger brother took it, and in a month, he came in, he held his head up, and he had the most beautiful blue eyes, and he smiled, and he said, And he said that he really felt a lot better. And the mother said he's talking with his relatives, their cousins, and people are coming over to visit him. And the older brother came in, and his head was down. they look very much alike from what I could see. And he said, "Do you think I might have that medicine you gave my brother?" I said, "Surely that can happen today, and I keep that on hand. So if someone agrees to it right away, you can give it to them." And he took it. And in 3 months, they were both in together. They were bright, cheerful. They were really able to communicate with other people. And, you know, once they know what real life is like, they don't want to get off of that medicine. They're terrified you're going to take them off of it. And that's why I went into psychiatry.